Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On the second half of this two-part conversation, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks to Dr. Kevin Curry Knight, Associate Professor at East Carolina University's College of Education. The two discuss the public education market, or rather, the lack thereof. Dr. Curry Knight wonders why choice opponents who are concerned about things such as the monopolistic market share of companies like Amazon or Walmart don't apply the same concern to public education, a monopoly where consumer spending is actually controlled by the supplier. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
One of the questions I sometimes like to ask folks of kind of a leftward persuasion when they're defending public schools is to think about the idea that we are being taught in schools what our rights are against the government, literally by the same branch of government that is most often violating or has an interest in violating our rights, the police, the law system, the legal system. And think about that. And to me, it just seems like a really amazing conflict of interest. But other people don't seem to have a problem with it. And I'm still trying to get my head around why that makes sense.
Well, there's a lot of discussion about social justice going on in the streets right now. So maybe that conversation is going to evolve a little bit.
It just seems like school is such an accepted part of our reality that we don't really think of it as a problem. I always urge people to think of school as if it were a big corporation, right? Like if you have a problem with Google or Walmart owning 60-some% of their market share because you think that that's going to corrupt them, they're going to do bad things for the people they serve and things like that. I mean, public schools have around a 90% market share nationwide. Right. So we should really be looking at public schools with the same sort of skepticism that we do a company that has at most a 60-70% market share. It doesn't seem to translate, and I'm not sure why. I know The Economist Glenn Lowry has been on several podcasts talking about the difference between the way we're talking about the police right now and the way we're talking about schools right now. So we're recording this after the very highly publicized deaths of several black men and one black woman. And we're talking about defunding the police, and we're talking about police unions as kind of obstructing justice, and they're kind of making sure that police reform can't happen. But yet, we don't really carry that same level of suspicion to schools and teachers' unions. And regardless of how you think about teachers' unions, I think the point is that there's this conflict, this double standard in how we're talking about these two groups. But if you think about it, it's also the case that the largest disparities between, racial groups happen in the legal system and the school system. So if anything, we should be looking at these two in a very similar way, but I'm kind of worried that we're looking at one of them very suspiciously and we're kind of turning a blind eye to the other.
I want to transition a little bit to another area where you've written quite a bit, and I think you're a very interesting thinker, which is, we talked about markets. And so you just give a nice transition, because the fact that the public education system is pretty much a monopoly.
By any conventional measure, people would say it's a monopoly. I mean, we can point out that there's school choice, but we can also point out that people don't have to shop at Amazon. But people still think of Amazon as a monopoly.
Yeah, and what's unique also in this situation is that consumer spending is actually controlled by the supplier.
As if
Amazon controlled your spending dollars. And so
that's right.
They don't have access to their public school dollars because it's controlled by the supplier.
Yeah.
So how do we get into this situation? I mean, you sort of alluded to it, but is it possible to have a highly effective and efficient public education system that's not also an efficient and effective market?
Yeah, so I mean, to that first question, how did we get into it in terms of state funding for public schools? It really varied by state, and in states like Massachusetts and New York, it was kind of gradual. So in the early 1800s, this is where I'll annoy some of the libertarian-leaning folks. there was not many places where public schooling, the idea of a government school, was controversial. I've looked through a lot of records and newspapers, and you don't see a lot of letters to the editor saying, "I don't want a government, you know, a school in my area that's government supported." But when districts and localities created a school that was funded partially by the taxes, they were still also supported by tuition. So they usually called them rate bills. And what happened is over time, reformers came about to say, you know, if we're going to create an effective school system, we need people to attend the public schools as much as possible, or what were usually called the common schools. And part of the problem is people still thought the private schools were often better. So people would go to private schools if they could afford it. Usually the tuition at public schools was much less than private schools, but people would still try to get the money together, go to private schools. So they petitioned for more and more tax funding, which would, first of all, lower the tuition. So, you know, it's the lower the tuition at public schools, the harder it is for people to justify going to private schools. And then at some point, they just were able to kind of abolish those rate bills, the tuition altogether, so that the public schools are ostensibly free and the private schools now cost money. Needless to say, a lot of private schools close under those conditions because they're competing with an ostensibly free, at least free at point of purchase, system. So it was almost a gradual but ultimately self-perpetuating cycle that the less expensive and more tax support the public schools got, the fewer private school options, the more people went to public school, things like that. So that's basically how it happened.
Is it possible to have a high quality public education system that isn't a highly functional market? I mean, there's not all the things that markets do. You know, customers can't signal what works and what doesn't work with suppliers. Right. It's hard. The barriers to entry are very, very high. It's hard to get innovation because the barriers to entry are so high. Consumers don't have the ability to vote with their feet to signal that's an innovation that they want because they're in a monopoly.
Right.
They're assigned to their neighborhood school by law. If you don't send your kid there, you go to jail. So, I mean, all the things that drive innovation every place else, most of those things don't exist in public education, which is why there's not much innovation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's several countries like the Netherlands comes to mind as a country that's pretty pretty strong on kind of the school choice front, and a lot of schools, even a lot of self-directed schools in the Netherlands get funding from the government. So you have a lot of innovation there. I actually had a student last semester who is from the Netherlands, and her and I would talk after class about the American school system because she was having trouble understanding it. It didn't make sense to her that the government essentially controlled that much of the school population and that school choice was such a controversial and especially political idea. Like, she had a hard time understanding that school choice, for historical reasons, seems to be a conservative idea. And she just didn't really understand that very well, because to her, it just isn't very controversial. So that was an interesting kind of learning experience for me as well. So you definitely have countries who are able to make good systems from essentially school choice or pluralistic model. I mean, I don't know. I know all the theoretical reasons, of course, why I think that schooling would be better off in a market, but I don't think there's been enough of a school choice plan that's in a country the size of ours for me to know, you know, what are the issues? Are there any potential downsides to that happening? I can't really think of any. I mean, most markets in the U.S. and elsewhere function pretty well. People who want cars can get cars. So there's, you know, one of the concerns I always hear is, well, what about kids who no school wants to take? Or, you know, so like, what about kids who have really costly disabilities? And my response is to say, you could design a school choice system, if that's a problem, you could design a choice system that incentivizes schools to take those kids. You talked, I think, recently with Steven Sugarman on your podcast, right? And he was one of the co-architects of a system that tried to do exactly that, which is, if you have a certain, thing about you or circumstance that makes you a more potentially costly student for schools, you would get more in terms of that school choice money than less. So it really depends on the plan. I'm sure there's some potential downsides to creating a complete market in education, but I have to imagine you can design a school choice plan around all of those that would foresee any of them.
Yeah, we're really fortunate. Jack Koons and Steve Sugarman are sort of part of our family here. And So we've had these conversations a lot, so it's fascinating. You know, they were around in the 60s and have been having these discussions for years.
Well, what's really interesting to me is, you know, there's a line that comes from folks like Diane Ravitch and Deborah Mayer and folks like that, that school choice is in some sense an engine of segregation. And it's largely kind of people who kind of want to increase segregation. And the people they never talk about are the people on the left, like Stephen Ahrens and Koons and Sugarman and Ted Sizer and even John Holt, right, who were saying, look, we've waited long enough for governments to try to desegregate schools. Even if you look at the numbers today of how segregated public schools are just by the districting laws, it's really staggering. I won't say that we've regressed since the 1950s, but we haven't made that much progress. It's stark. And they were saying, look, you know, we've waited long enough for governments to prove to us that they can desegregate schools. If we give kids the option of, or parents and families the option of disconnecting their school from their zip code, there's every reason to think that we'll get more integration in schools. And I guess, you know, Mayer and Ravitch could argue that they're wrong. But what bothers me is I never see them mention those figures, that this was not only an issue on the conservative right, this was an issue on the progressive left.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Mississippi Freedom Party and the whole freedom schools throughout the South, there's a long history on the political left of education choice, particularly in the civil rights movement. And if you look at our program in Florida, you know, 120,000 plus kids, low-income kids, mainly of color, whose families skew heavily on the Democratic side, who are voting for their feet on behalf of their child. So it's why it's portrayed in a particular way as a conservative issue. If you understand the history and if you look at families sitting around the kitchen table, it's really an issue of what's best for my child. And it's cuts across the political spectrum in terms of people who really want to use choice to advocate for their child.
Yeah, I was talking to Robert Pondicio, who wrote a book, trying to remember the title. It's How the Other Half Learns, where he goes into the Success Academy, Harlem Success Academy charter school. And I have issues with charters because they're not quite a market school, so to speak. But he said it to me this way, and I think he puts it in the book. He says, Success Academy, which teaches primarily black and brown students of low income, if it were its own school district, it would not only outperform every area of New York City, it would perform by far better than any district in the state. That's interesting. And people who care about, you know, social justice, especially along the lines of race and income, that should make their ears perk up. Because if that's true, that's an amazing pro for the school choice side.
Yeah. Well, you've been very generous with your time. You've given us a lot to work with, and I'm very grateful, and I hope that we continue to have dialogue. I know you've written a piece for our blog, for our parents, that I think is going to be really interesting.
I'll just put in one last plug for any parents or families who are interested in schooling at home outside of a school system, what it can look like, should look at Learning by Living podcast. I do it with Gina Riley. We interview a whole bunch of people who have been in schools and been in self-directed spaces and tell their story of either learning that way or watching other people learn that way. I think people can get a lot of inspiration from those.